Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
I'm Father Matt Malone, Editor-in-Chief of America Magazine. I'm joined by Father Eric Sundrup and by Zach Davis, who is a associate editor at America. We're talking about the news and analysis from the pages and the website of America Magazine, which you can find at americamagazine.org. And you can find all of the stories we're talking about today at americamagazine.org/Sirius. Of course, you know, all of the news in the church right now is still about this terrible report we saw from the state grand jury in Pennsylvania about six dioceses and their handling of sexual abuse cases over a period of 70 years. The grand jury report documented, hundreds of cases of abuse, and perhaps even more disturbing than that horrific crime, the cover-up by some officials of the church, and not failing to report those and to hold people accountable.
Right, and it is Attorney General Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania has noted that this is an ongoing investigation for them, and that they've had a hotline that's been receiving more and more allegations since last Tuesday's report. And so I don't think we're going to stop hearing about this anytime soon.
No, I don't think so either. And as you know, Zach, we had a Facebook Live event where we talked about this from our studio in New York, because people come at this news from different places. You know, I had lived through the sexual abuse crisis in Boston. Zach, you were too young to do that, so mm-hmm. we're experiencing this at different levels, and of course I think everyone is just trying to make some sense of it to the extent that it's possible.
Yeah, I don't know how to make sense of it. I think that there's so much problematic here, and it's not. I think there's an instinct in some places to, like, let's get past this. I don't think we're getting past this.
No, I don't think so either, and that's probably a good thing, because yep. we need to pause as a church and act to ensure that this never happens again. And one of the things that I was talking about in my recent column about this, which is titled "The Plague of Sexual Abuse is Worse Than You Think," you can find that and all of the articles we're talking about today at americamagazine.org. One of the things that really struck me as I was reading this report, which is horrible, and one really should put on some serious spiritual armor to read this stuff because it is so terrifying. One of the things that really struck me was, if it is this bad in the church, how bad is it elsewhere? Elsewhere within the church and then outside of the church? Because what we're talking about here are six dioceses of nearly 200 dioceses in the United States, not to mention the religious orders and the administrative areas of the Eastern churches. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot more to come. And this is itself a part of a larger story, which is the reality of sexual abuse in this country. If you think about it, you have, as I talked about in this piece, one in five girls, one in 12 boys are sexually abused before their 18th birthday. 90% of boys and girls are abused by someone they know. 50% of the victims under six, and 25% of the victims between 12 and 17 are abused by a member of their own family. This is everywhere, right? And as I was reading the report from Pennsylvania, I thought to myself, this is horrific. What the church has done and what it has failed to do. But it's also largely about events that took place more than 25 years ago over a period of seven decades. This is a reality that can, but the reality of sexual abuse is something that's happening right now among us, both within and without the church.
That's right. And I think we are in an era, it calls to mind the Me Too movement of we're taking sexual abuse seriously, maybe for the first time as a society, and we're in this sort of cultural period of letting the truth come out, mm-hmm. right? and holding, you know, recognizing these as sins, both in a religious and secular sense, and abuses of power. And so that also is not something I think that's over. You know, there's a new story from some high profile person, almost always a man,
right.
You know, once a week.
Right. Right. Yeah, because we know, I mean, the reality of this is certainly when it comes to childhood sexual abuse or minors under the age of 18, the overwhelming number of perpetrators are male.
Mm-hmm.
The overwhelming number of victims are females. And except in the church, we have this unique demographic where it was predominantly males who were abused
right.
by other males. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in a second. But yeah, the story within the church is part of a larger national story, which is itself a part of this moment in mm-hmm. the life of the country, where we are in an agonizing way coming into consciousness about these realities, not just childhood sexual abuse, but generally the abuse of power, sexual harassment, and misogyny.
Yeah, I think another aspect of this is you see so many people begging, calling for the leadership of the church to react differently than, you know, standard leadership would in society. And what is so damning about the grand jury report is they reacted worse in many cases than sort of secular leadership in that. And you would hold them or expect them to stand something different. But the very worst abuses of power and secrecy and cronyism were on display in what we're seeing in some of these patterns.
Yeah, I mean, and at best, the response was uneven.
Yeah, right.
I mean, and there are folks who are still in power, Cardinal Wuerl in Washington, who has taken some fire for how his actions are depicted in this report, had a very uneven response. Mm-hmm. You know, in some cases seemed to do the right thing, and others seemed to absolutely not do the right thing. And, you know, so all of that is being sorted out, not only it's being sorted out at a legal level, it's being sorted out at an ecclesial level, a political level, and all of it's, of course, playing out in the media. So it can be difficult to get your head and your heart around all of this.
Mm-hmm. And I think the frustrating thing that sits with a lot of people is what are the recourses of action, mm-hmm. right? There are a lot of barriers to, you know, achieving justice, whether those are, you know, statutes of limitation laws, whether or not, you know, there's a mandated reporter law being enforced mm-hmm. in a lot of cases. And this cuts across the secular sphere and in the church sphere. And then with the church in particular, it's how do you hold bishops accountable?
Right.
Right. Who are they accountable to? Well, it's really only one person.
Right.
At least from a governance level, right? And that's the Pope.
Right. So who is responsible not only for the 300 bishops in the United States, but every bishop everywhere, right?
Right.
And so, I mean, what we keep coming back to in this is that the only person who can, quote-unquote, fire a bishop, the only one who can request a bishop's resignation, the only one who has the authority to put a new person in place is the Holy Father. And, you know, that makes good sense for a lot of the good theological reasons. But, you know, to your point, Zach, how does that actually play out in the real world in a crisis like this?
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, what is he supposed to do? I mean, because one imagines being there in Rome, head of the Universal Church, that he is probably not spending all of his day focused on the problems of the U.S. Church.
No,
right?
and you know, there was a report in the Associated Press today. The United States is not the only country going through its own sexual abuse crisis within the Catholic Church right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are all kinds of things showing up at Pope Francis's desks that he's got to make decisions on.
Right. Yeah, because we have sexual abuse crisis in Ireland. We have it in Latin America, throughout Africa. I mean, this is a reality. Everywhere that sexual abuse exists, the church is going to be confronted by this issue, and it exists everywhere.
Right.
That was the point of the piece that I my modest contribution to this conversation, which you can find at americamagazine.org/serious. That piece is called "The Plague of Sexual Abuse is Worse Than You Think." you know, that there, I can say that just as a guy who was born in 1972 and grew up in the 1970s and then and 80s and came in really into adulthood in the 1990s, that my own understanding of these things evolved over time, you know, that and when I look back now on my own childhood, you know, there were signs both within and without the church of things that were not right, right? And but we weren't taught how to recognize those signs. We were mm-hmm. certainly weren't taught what to do about it. But it is funny how this report, this moment in the life of the church, has really kind of woken up me, brought me to a place of consciousness about the reality of this, not only today, but then kind of second guessing things that I saw and heard when I was a kid and when I was growing up.
Right. And, you know, we're still developing tools on how to deal with things and how to, you know, get resources in order to have these conversations or in order to have people accountable. But I think the frustrating thing for a lot of people is you can't begin to figure that out if you don't know what's happening.
Right.
Right.
That's right.
And this is sort of a place where the Editors of America pointed out in the editorial in this next issue on the crisis is that, you know, this Pennsylvania grand jury report was happening in six dioceses.
Right.
There, and you can almost be certain that each and every diocese around the country has its own story to tell.
Yep.
That it hasn't
told
yet. You can
be absolutely certain of it.
Right? And it hasn't been told yet, by and large. There are a few cases where it has, and we should look to those and, you know, emulate them.
And yeah. there has to be full and immediate disclosure.
I mean, and that was the editorial. The call was a full and immediate disclosure of these records and the information that we have.
To get ahead of it.
Get it out there.
You know, I mean, one of the things that the church and its leadership can do to signal that it's taking this seriously and that it believes what the survivors are saying about what happened is to come out and say, this is what happened before we're forced to do so by the civil authorities. And the alternative, of course, is to be forced to do it diocese by diocese, drip, drip, agonizing drip of information mm-hmm. Over the next 5 years, right? And
5 minutes. You could see this lasting 20.
Yeah, exactly. So there's no alternative. In my mind, there's no alternative to full and immediate disclosure. I think one of the difficulties is that, you know, you have the dioceses that are effectively, on this question, run by their council rather than by their bishop. Right. And, you know, everybody needs good legal counsel. You need the best legal advice possible. Sometimes you have to ignore it. Sometimes the priority that of being a pastor, of being a human being, has to take over any kind of legal concern or, you know, the vulnerability that you're going to expose you and your assets to. Mm-hmm. Right. You just at this point, we're dealing with such a profound pastoral crisis in the life of the church in this country that our principal concern just has to be getting the truth out, no matter the costs.
Right.
You know, whatever it costs us in time and treasure, you know, it won't be the end of us. But this could be if we don't get at the truth and because that's the only way forward in terms of reconciliation. Now, other people have different ideas about what we should do about this, and there's no shortage of them on Catholic Twitter. And again,
is Catholic Twitter truly Catholic?
Yeah, and is it truly Twitter? I don't know. I don't know. That's an interesting question for another time, I guess. But the so you can find all of this information again at americamagazine.org/serious. There was another piece, Father Eric, that you brought to our conversation today that was written by Nathan Schneider, who's a contributing writer to America, based in Colorado. And he has written a piece called Don't Blame the Sex Abuse Crisis on Queer Catholics. What he's responding to here, I think, is the calls by some to eliminate or to both remove and to ensure that they are not admitted into the priesthood, people who men who self-identify as gay or homosexual. Mm-hmm. And the thinking being, the people who are making this argument, that you know, most of these incidences within the church, unlike the general population, involved males preying on boys, right?
Right.
And therefore, let's remove, let's remove males who have a same-sex attraction from the priesthood. Nathan talks about why he thinks there are some problems with that.
Yeah, and Zach's and I have talked about this several times ourselves, and Zach brought this forward. It's actually Zach that was bringing this one forward. And it's interesting to me, we were making that joke about Catholic Twitter. Like, this was the second tweet storm I had seen in response to an article that was essentially making that point that, you know, because of this sex abuse crisis, then we shouldn't have men who identify as with a homosexual orientation in the priesthood, that they're therefore
And it's important to note that this isn't just Catholic Twitter that's having this conversation.
Right.
It's happening in journals of religion and public life in this country. It's happening. Bishops are making this argument. I saw a cardinal tweeting about this today as well. So I think there is a sense to try and figure out what's going on with this sex abuse crisis. And Nathan makes a very compelling case, and I think he's right, that trying to scapegoat priests who identify as queer is the wrong move, both from a pastoral move and a logical move.
Right. Right. I mean, look, in my mind, there are several problems with this idea. The first is that, you know, if you ask experts on childhood sexual abuse, most of the people who are perpetrate sexual abuse of minors would actually self-identify as heterosexual, right? So that's problem number one. Problem number two is, you know, when you look at the general population, you know, the overwhelming number of abusers in this country are males, and the overwhelming number of victims are females, right? Now, who thinks that a reasonable response to that reality is to say that, you know, men who have opposite sex attraction should be barred from marriage or teaching or from your neighborhood, right? It's not intelligible, right? I think we're grasping for something that isn't there. Mm-hmm. Right, because we're dealing with it at the level of concept rather than at the level of the individual. And, you know, I mean, in the end, it follows from the canons of formal logic that since there are good, healthy, celibate, homosexual priests, there can be good, celibate, healthy, homosexual priests, right? I mean, it's a reality. Most people in this country who are Catholic have been ministered to at some time in their life whether they know it or not, by a priest who understands himself to be gay, right? And so why throw the baby out with the bathwater?
Right, and you see, in homosexuality is not the only sort of identity or trait that's sort of being blamed for this. A lot of people are still saying, you know, if only Catholic priests weren't celibate, mm-hmm. maybe this would not be a problem. And I think that's wrong for a number of other reasons, right? The Me Too movement has shown this country, if anything, is that sexual abuse happens whether people are having lots of sex or no sex.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Or whether they're married or not.
Right. And in fact, most abusers are married.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And someone pointed this out, that I saw a tweet that said, that argument is making this assumption that Catholic women are to be responsible for bearing the sexual violence that these priests would be
That's buried within the suppositions of that argument.
Yeah. Right, is that this is on Catholic women to take this on,
right,
to protect children, which right. is a twisted and...
Yeah, it's the kind of faulty conclusion you get from a faulty premise.
Right.
Right. And, you know, I think in the end, the church will see it for what it is. But, I mean, as you point out, Zach, you know, serious people are taking this proposal seriously. And I think the part of it is it's just our attempt to try to understand something that is fundamentally and ultimately mysterious. It's evil, right? Mm-hmm. And what I think we should be talking about in the end is what kind of structural reforms and what kind of changes we're going to make to the way in which we recruit, screen, and train priests to ensure that things like this don't happen again. And when they do, which is probably inevitable at some point in history, how are they held accountable by their superiors?
I'm always intrigued when I see arguments like this that like so obviously fall on their face in logic, right? When they just completely fall apart like this. My question is frequently, what motivates someone toward that argument? Why would people who I would consider intelligent and capable of catching some of these things, what pushes them into these areas? And I think you got to recognize that this is so catastrophic, and people are grasping to try and fix this as quickly as possible and have something, a solution they can hold on to and say, we've done something about this. But they're being faced with a problem which is so evil and multi-layered and complex. It's going to defy, you know, this is the silver bullets.
Right.
And so when we are faced with the need for massive structural change, right, I understand the impetus to find, well, this is the one thing that we can do. No, that's not going to fix that.
And the idea that focusing on the sexual identity of priest writ large or the perpetrators writ large,
right,
is sort of the stunted analysis for confronting the sexual abuse crisis,
correct,
right? It sort of stops the buck at a place where, in fact, we need to go much larger,
much
broader.
Yeah. Right. That in a sense, the proposal isn't radical enough, right?
It's actually quite
common. It's a form of just basic scapegoating. It's how a lot of people deal with problems. But what you're saying is, I think, is that we need a far more radical solution than that.
Absolutely.
Right? Something that goes deeper and broader.
And one that something that I think keeps getting missed in a lot of these analyses.
And a series of solutions, not just a solution.
Right, exactly. And that will take time and conversion and structural reform. But I think something that we miss also when we focus on proposals like banning gay priests or something like that is, are we listening to survivors of abuse? Are we listening to victims? And I think in a push to fix everything, which might be rooted in a good impulse, we fail to stop and listen and pause and hear from the people that we have wronged,
right,
and hear their hurt and what they have to say.
Right.
Yeah. And that takes great courage. And I think there will be so many opportunities to be fearful going forward here. And so, mm-hmm, it will take serious vigilance to avoid giving into those fears.
Yeah. I also think, Zach, that you are right to point out that, look, people who make a proposal like this, which we've just discovered all three of us disagree with, that we should not immediately question their motives, that they're hurting too. And it could very well be that this is the thing they think we need to do to solve this problem, and that they have an interest in solving it. And that's an important thing to do from the point of view of our own Christian virtue. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We've been talking about the news and the views at the intersection of the church and the world, as we do each week. When we come back, more of the news and analysis from America Magazine, and we'll be joined a little later on by Hoffman Ospino, who's going to be talking about the turning point that came in Medellin in the life of the church's 20th century theology. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel. Stay with us.
Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
We are back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. I'm Father Matt Malone, editor-in-chief of America Magazine. I'm joined by Father Eric Sundrup and by Zach Davis, who is an associate editor at America. We're talking about the news and analysis from the pages and the website of America Magazine, which you can find at americamagazine.org. And you can find all of the stories we're talking about today at americamagazine.org/Sirius. We just had this one other piece, which I guess, Father Eric, you brought to the table.
Yeah.
Because I was confused about our last story. That I just want to mention before we talk about Medellin and we're joined by the great Hoffman Ospino, which is this piece that we have from Stephen P. White about evangelization. Evangelization isn't getting people to fall in line. It's getting them to fall in love. Why'd you bring that?
It actually ties into some of the things we were just talking about, the idea of how we can tend to get abstract about morality and other things. And this is, you know, I'm used to hearing all these discussions about the new evangelization, or how we're going to evangelize the young adults, or how we're going to get people back in the pews. And there's always a back and forth. And there's so often I hear this premise of they don't know all of the theories or the rules. And so we just need to explain those further to them. And this article gets at, you know, and Pope Francis has been talking about this for some time now, that's probably not the way that's going to work. And so there's this line in here, Stephen White says, he wants to shake up the church to shake us out of complacency and a tendency to moral abstraction.
Right.
And so what I love is the title there is Fall in Love, Not in Line.
Right.
Fall in love is to speak a common language, to share a common experience, to be vulnerable, to be open to change. Those are different than falling in line.
Yeah.
And so bringing that forward, and that's hard to do. I also recognize why, I understand why it's much easier to give a presentation on evangelization that, you know, doubles down on a catechetical pedagogy.
Right.
Because then you can do that quickly. But, you know, asking the question about how do you get people to fall in love with the gospel, with the person of Christ, with the church, that is, again, far more complex, far more difficult, will take much more effort. And so that's why I brought this forward at this time. I think I would like us to have the zeal, and, you know, hagan lío is the Spanish phrase that Francis used, make a mess, you know, to have the zeal to go out there and try that.
Right. I think that's right.
And here's something relating this back to the sexual abuse crisis, is that I think any lay minister, priest, bishop worth their salt has to realize that the toll that the church's teaching authority to be received is going to take from this.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? You might say it logically does not follow that because the crimes of a few affects the truth of a claim, but it is a natural impulse in someone to say, why should I listen to this if this is happening over here?
Right. Right. And I would say that the crisis is, the threat is even graver than that, because it compromises the church's ability to make what Pope Francis calls the first proclamation, mm-hmm. which is that the Lord is risen,
mm-hmm.
right? Because if people have trouble finding credible anything you say, right, then they're going to have trouble finding credible everything you say,
right?
And that's the most important thing that we say.
Right, that right? We need to be able to tell people the good news.
Right.
And if we can't, then, as you said earlier, this could sink us.
If we have no credibility on the bad news, we're going to be compromised in proclaiming the good news.
That's right.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. And it's a temptation constantly to think that if we have the right idea about something, that we will then act rightly. Right.
Right.
The discipleship is not about being right. It's about being holy.
Well,
and that is a journey. It requires a field hospital, not a classroom.
Well, you make that phrase, you know, it's not about being right, it's about being holy. And holiness is much bigger than being right.
It absolutely
is. It's a way bigger concept.
And St. Paul knew that, right?
Yeah.
He's like, I know what the right thing to do is, and I keep doing the wrong thing.
Right.
This isn't a new idea. This is the very first fruits of religion.
Indeed.
And they're also not separate concepts, too. And I think that's the article brings that some of that out, too, which is important. Like, you know, holiness is not going to be devoid of right.
No, of course not. And, you know, because we're talking about truth. But what's essential is to remember that ultimately, for Christians, truth is a person. Mm-hmm. And his name is Jesus Christ.
Right.
And what matters most is our living relationship with that person. Right. And everything else that we proclaim as a church to be true is only going to make sense at an existential level, a lived level, in light of that relationship and in the context of that relationship. Speaking of theology on the ground and lived spirituality, we have this really interesting piece by Hoffman Espino and Rafael Luciani about how Latin America has played a hugely influential role in the development of the church's understanding of its place in the modern world over the last 50 years. It's called How Latin America Influenced the Entire Catholic Church. And Hoffman Espino is an associate professor of Hispanic ministry and religious education at Boston College. And he joins us on the line from Boston. Hello, doctor.
How are you, Father Malone?
I'm very well. How are you doing? It's nice to talk to you again.
Nice talking to you. I'm doing well. Thank you.
So, why is it that you and Dr. Luciani decided to write this article? And for those who are listening who haven't read it, what is your thesis?
Sure. Well, the article is pretty much about the 50th anniversary of Medellin, a meeting of the Latin American bishops right after the Second Vatican Council in the city of Medellin, Colombia. And the organization was just founded, you know, I mean, it had been recently founded only 13 years earlier. And the bishops of Latin America who participated during the council, you know, they came back, you know, fired up, you know, about what it meant to live the gospel and to live the council and to be a church that engages the world, the contemporary world, in the Latin American context. So they decided to gather together, you know, and at first they wanted to gather in Rome, and Pope Paul VI told them, no, you should meet in Colombia or in Latin America, you know, you should meet in your own continent. And they did, you know. So that 1968 meeting became a groundbreaking meeting because for the first time, you know, the bishops of Latin America, with a large number, a significant number of theologians, began to reflect, what does it mean to be a Catholic and to embrace or bring to life the teachings of the Council 3 years earlier, you know, into the context of Latin America, where there was poverty, there was war, there were dictatorships, there was a lot of struggle. So the article, in a sense, you know, is an overview of some of the key insights about, you know, what Medellin did and how those insights, you know, for the last 50 years have been evolving, not only in Latin America, but also through the magisterium, through church teaching at the universal level, and most evidently now with Pope Francis in Rome, you know, bringing many of the ideas that actually are right there, you know, a lot of the key ideas about poverty and about evangelization and mission and so forth. These were ideas that were in a seminal stage already in Medellin 50 years ago, maturing throughout Latin America, and it's exciting to see how they are now part of the universal language of Catholics, you know, worldwide.
Yeah, I've heard from folks that in a sense the body of reflection that this papacy is offering the church is in a sense the fullest flowering of the Medellin initiative, and you and Dr. Luciani mentioned in this piece that Medellin really revolutionized pastoral and theological reflection in Latin America and across the church. So what were the two or three insights that they had that have made a difference?
Sure. I think that one of the first contributions of Medellin was the appropriation of a method that actually was not Latin American. You know, it was the See, Judge, Act methodology that had been used by Catholic Action all throughout the world, you know. But the bishops of Latin America at Medellin decided to make this a methodology for their own reflections. And literally, you know, what they did is, you know, use sociology, they used anthropology, they used the expertise of people from different fields, historians, theologians, and so forth, and began to analyze the reality. And frankly, that hadn't been done in a very explicit way throughout most of Latin America, and it became a groundbreaking way of doing theology and engaging the reality, because people were asking, okay, when we talk about poverty, what does it mean to be poor? You know, when we talk about justice and peace, and when we talk about the engagement of the elites and so forth. So all of a sudden, you know, the bishops got excited, and the method, in many ways, is an opportunity, you know, somehow to move towards action. You know, Medellin, you know, is a reminder that theology needs to be for the life of the world, that theology needs to be for the transformation of reality, And that's in many ways one of the key contributions. Another contribution that I would highlight is, in the article we talk about synodality. You know, today that's a word that, you know, theologians and pastoral leaders and commentators are, you know, we throw and we say that Pope Francis is really big on synodality, but Medellin, as a matter of fact, embraced synodality right as the modus operandi of doing their deliberations in 1968. Pretty much, you know, and this is not rocket science. It's simply, you know, the exercise of collaborating and discussing, you know, I mean, listening to one another.
Right. You know, synodality just being the Pope working in conjunction with the bishops and the theological academy to reflect together.
Absolutely.
On the church's direction.
And the laity as well, and the and experts from different fields. So let's listen to one another.
That makes total sense to me, and it might make sense to a lot of people who are, you know, growing up now or learning theology now. But what was theology, you know, the idea that theology must be informed by the world around it. But what was the idea before that? How did you do theology?
Yeah, well, the break was primarily from neo-scholastic theology, you know, Latin America, most of the theology that was done in Latin America back then, and still actually is being done in many places, I have to say, you know, it was this neo-scholastic model, you know, using manuals and texts, you know. I mean, it's kind of, it's almost assuming that, you know, there has been little history or no history after Thomas Aquinas, you know, and then, you know, what these people began
and actually championing its kind of ahistorical quality, right, as a form of timelessness.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so important for people to recognize that shift. Theology study would have been, as the question was asked by Thomas, and then the response by Thomas, and that was how theology was being done.
By an authority, that's right. I mean, it was the over-reliance on authorities, and usually dead authorities, you know. So, I mean, you can't confront them, you know, pretty much, you know. But what the bishops were doing here is simply, I mean, or the model of theology that emerges is, let's start, you know, by inserting ourselves in the reality and listen to the questions that people are asking, looking at, you know, what's affecting their lives, and that really changes the way you do theology.
Yeah, indeed it does. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We're talking with Dr. Hoffman Ospino of Boston College about his article in America, How Latin America Influenced the Entire Catholic Church. You can find that at americamagazine.org/Sirius. I feel obligated to say, as a Thomist, that it was this particular brand of Thomism that was problematic.
I was
the real Thomas is okay.
I was waiting for the rebuttal. I was like, I just gave it. They're not going to let that stand. True Thomists are going to come back at me.
So more on that, more of our conversation with Dr. Ospino when we come back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel. Stay with us.
Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
We're back. You're listening to America This Week. I'm Father Matt Malone, editor-in-chief of America Magazine. I'm joined by Father Eric Sundrup and Zach Davis, who are on the staff of America. We're talking about the news and the views at the intersection of the church and the world, which you can find at americamagazine.org/Sirius. And in particular, we're talking with Dr. Hoffman Ospino of Boston College about his article, co-authored with Dr. Raphael Luciani, titled How Latin America Influenced the Entire Catholic Church. And Dr. Ospino was just saying before we went to break that that this meeting of bishops in Medellin set a new direction for theological reflection that was more historical, that was closer to the ground, that accounted for the political, social, economic context in which this reflection was taking place. And Zach, during the break, you posed a question to me, which I think was a great one for Dr. Ospino.
That's right. I'm wondering, you know, in a certain sense, how Latin America influenced the entire Catholic Church. Was there any resistance to this model of doing church or doing theology?
Yes, well, certainly, you know, much of what happened at Medellin crystallized what today is known as liberation theology. So we all know that, you know, the reaction to liberation theology has not been too friendly in many ways.
It's a dirty word in some households.
It is. And even countries in Latin America, you know, almost entirely banned, you know, that kind of theology. I mean, I was born in Colombia. And I have to say that growing up and even studying philosophy and theology, I rarely studied any liberation theology, you know. But I mean, today, as a matter of fact, you know, the liberationist method or theologies of liberation are better received in universities. So yes, there was a reaction. And I think that the biggest reaction, as a matter of fact, of the type of theology that emerged and was done in Medellin had to do with the methods that were used. You know, I mean, some people, I mean, sometimes there is, in liberation theology, there is the use of Marxist analysis, for instance, you know, without having the theologian having to become a communist or a socialist or anything like that. However, you know, it was misunderstood in many circles. But also there were excesses in liberation theology. You know, there were some clergy and some lay people who actually became guerrillas, leaders, and so. But Medellin, in a sense, you know, brings this kind of awareness about social realities and structural change and structural sin. You know, Medellin speaks of sin as something that doesn't happen in the abstract, or is just, you know, someone just made a mistake and I'm really bad, and then, you know, you go to confession and everything goes well. No, but Medellin speaks about sin as being, you know, structural sin, social sin, and instead of asking why we sin, you know, Medellin asks, what are the causes of poverty? What are the causes of war and, you know, and the causes of injustice? And that, you know, I mean, especially for people who are in power, you know, or people who are kind of in a continent that is mostly Catholic, you know, many of the people who were behind the injustice and many of the people who were behind the, you know, the causes of poverty were Roman Catholics, and they didn't want to be questioned, you know.
Right.
So I think that Medellin stepped on some toes, you know, and certainly there was reaction.
Both in the church and outside of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And there grew out of this movement called liberation theology, which, as you point out, would prove to be quite controversial, because some people saw it as having this kind of Marxist influence, and in the heat of the Cold War, that was a big no-no. And or folks also might have seen it as too worldly, right? That we're focused now, we overcorrected in a sense. We're too focused on the world, not enough on heaven. And, you know, those are caricatures, of course, but how is it that today that you maintain that balance, right? Because when you go back to Medellin, you see that they're attempting to rebalance theological reflection, right? So how do you do that today? How do you focus on the lived context in which theology is theological reflection is taking place without actually losing sight of the things of heaven?
Right. I think that one of the best examples that we see today is you know, the work that Pope Francis is doing. You know, I mean, I guess that I and potentially you may have a bias towards Pope Francis and what he's doing.
Pope Francis S.J.
S.J., that's right. but what I'm thinking, you know, I mean, Pope Francis, and I have to say that Pope Benedict, you know, in some of his work as well, you know, I'm thinking of the work that, you know, his work on hope, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Somehow struck, you know, he struck an amazing balance. This idea that, you know, one cannot be a disciple of Jesus Christ and then look around and see poverty, see injustice, and do nothing, you know.
Right.
And the other way around, you know, when you see injustice, you know, somehow you are there's an obligation to see the face of Christ and to pray and to develop this, you know, profound spirituality. So it is possible to do both. We have great examples. Most of the saints that we have today as models of the faith actually have done that. You know, the problem is the excesses and the overcorrections. You're absolutely right. You know, when we start shifting towards the polarities of our spiritual life, forgetting one end or the other. But I love this idea of being both mystical and prophetic, you know, and certainly Ignatian spirituality has a lot to do with that, you know, but we need to keep both. You know, this is not an either or, but both.
You in the article, you point out that Hispanic Catholics are really soon, might already be there, are going to constitute half the Catholics in the United States. What do you think are the concrete ways we're going to see that shift? You know, you talk about how they're influenced by what happened in Medellin, liberation theology, and all those movements. What do you think we're going to be seeing in local parishes? Are we going to see anything, or is this going to happen in different places?
Well, the thing is that if we look at the immigrant population, the Latino Catholic immigrant population, So many of us were, educated in Latin America. We were exposed one way or another to some of these ideas, about evangelization, about justice, mission, and so forth. You know, the language that Pope Francis uses today, is language that comes from the Latin American theological and pastoral world, and it's almost second language for many of the immigrants from Latin America. But my hope is that many of these leaders will actually bring this into their parishes, in our theology and the way we teach and the way we act, in vis-a-vis evangelization. Now, the challenge is that the vast majority of Latinos, as a matter of fact, are U.S.-born, and they were not exposed to these dynamics. Two-thirds of Latinos are U.S.-born. So, on the one hand, the hope is that through education in both catechesis and theological education, they may get a little bit of this, and Pope Francis is certainly helping with that, with his pontificate and these beautiful documents that he is putting out. But on the other hand, there is the challenge that the new generation of Latinos stay in the church, because, which could be another, an entirely different conversation.
Another show.
We're losing too many of them, unfortunately. Yes.
Right.
Picking up on that, I mean, it is a question of whether or not, we're going to minister to or pay attention to, you spoke of the young church, the church under 18 is already majority Latino, right? Mm-hmm. And it is certain that more than half of the resources for young adults and youth in the United States are geared towards Latino ministry. So mm-hmm. I guess, does it matter of whether or not the church, responds to this new population?
Well, I certainly, two things on this. One, if the Catholic Church as an institution does not pay attention and invest in Hispanic youth, frankly, by the middle of the 20th century, we will be half the size that we are today. No, it's just it's just basic math and basic demographics.
Right.
And half. Two, at least half, absolutely. Yeah. That's the way. When you combine the aging of the particularly your American white population and the defection among young Latinos, Asians, and other young people, young Catholics, then that's a big exodus that we're seeing. But on the other hand, the Catholic Church really needs to, to invest in Latinos, not just for self-preservation, but it is the right thing to do, simply.
Right.
Just we need to introduce these young women and men to Jesus Christ. That's our obligation, and we need to do much more.
Right. Now, as you point out, this method of theological reflection demands that we take into account the social, political, economic, the lived experience of people, the context in which this reflection is taking place. So, of course, now here in the United States, the theological reflection is taking place in the midst of scandal, right? And collapsing credibility and authority of the church. So what might the Medellin way have to say about the current crisis that we're facing in, around sexual abuse and then the misconduct of bishops?
Yeah. Well, the bishops of Medellin, the bishops, when they began their meeting, they made a pledge, and their pledge was to, walk with the community, walk with the people, not just walk with the church, because that could be interpreted as walking with the institution and this large tradition in the abstract, But they made a pledge, we are going to walk and journey with the people, especially those who are most vulnerable, los pobres, the poor. And you see that all throughout the document of Medellin, but also you see it in Aparecida, and you see it through many other documents in the church in Latin America, which is beautiful, and also in the theology. I think that, from Medellin, we can also, we can bring some of that energy, and I would love to see our bishops as well, not only to pledge to journey with those who are most vulnerable and affected by all these scandals, which is pretty much everybody, but at the same time show clear ways, that they are journeying through, the way they write their documents, the way they are, committing resources to the different communities, the way they are operating, in their ministries. And it's doable. The bishops have done it. And I know that bishops in Asia and there are bishops in Africa who are also doing something similar. So we can do it here as well.
Yeah, and we have about a minute left, but we should certainly remember that this different way of doing theology and theological reflection was a great threat to the status quo, both within the church and without. And a lot of people paid for that with their lives, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, well, certainly we have, you know, Archbishop Romero, who, you know, is going to be canonized this fall semester in October. And also we got Bishop Angelelli from Argentina, who was one of the champions of Medellin. And his cause for canonization actually, you know, was opened recently. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of people, we got Bishop Girardi in Guatemala and a few others who have died. So, yeah, people, there are martyrs. But I think, you know, Jesus led the way. So I guess so be it.
He did, and he still does today. Yep. So the piece is called How Latin America Influenced the Entire Catholic Church. It's by Hoffman Espino and Rafael Luciani of Boston College. Dr. Espino, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Father Malone. Take care.
Take care now. Of course, this is one of the reasons why America Magazine has an initiative focused on the question of Hispanics, Latinos, and their integration into the full life of the church in this country, which Dr. Espino has been an integral part of in helping us organize. And you can find out about that at americamagazine.org. You can find all of the content that we talked about today at americamagazine.org/serious. You know, we don't just report the news and offer analysis at America. We are also people of faith and attempting to live it in the same way that you, our listeners, are. So we're mindful of what it is that you are experiencing at this time and singularly focused on providing you the resources to help you make sense of the church and the world, this critical moment in our lives. You can find it at americamagazine.org. And you can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. And to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Father Eric Sundrup and Zach Davis, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.